on Petty Wash Day. Pidamia for joining me this week for Ohomani Iotaka. Gather in a circle and sit down at storytelling time. I am your host, Donna Hawkes. And we continue, of course, with our reading of Water Lily by Ella DeLoria. And we only have this reading and next week's reading, and we will be done with Water Lily. We've been reading this for quite a long while. We know that Echo, her husband, Water Lily, Taluta, and a few other family members have left their original camp circle. And this was done, people were going in many different directions, leaving the original camp circle, except for those people who were sick and who had the authority to remain. And that was because the blankets that were intentionally infected with the smallpox virus and were given out to different tribes. And the Dakota tribe, Lakota, Nakota, and many people perished. Many, many people. They didn't have the ability, the immune system, to fight this infection. And that's a historical fact, unfortunately. But it was done. And so in our novel of Water Lily, Water Lily leaves with these relatives and these in-laws in her husband, Sacred Horse, to move away from the camp in an effort to save themselves from this disease. So now, let's begin. As it turned out, the little company escaped nothing by running away. Echo and her mother had thoroughly exposed themselves to the disease in their zeal to comfort the sorrowful. They had visited the stricken homes without fear, unaware of the contagious nature of the affliction. Now, ironically, they were carrying along with them the deadly thing from which they were fleeing. Soon it was to break out in all its ravaging fury, and their stay in the wilds was to become a series of unforgettable horrors. Conceivably, there might be days just as bad in the future. It was hard to imagine that any could be worse. It was like an evil dream, was the way it would be recalled in after years. Starting with the senior wife, Taluta, mother of Echo and Sacred Horse, everyone in the party had the disease. Once begun, it was inevitable that it went the round. All nine persons were occupying one teepee, sick and well side by side. They were resigned to this. Certainly, nobody dreamed of isolating the first case as a check against further spread. Had one dared suggest doing so, it would only have shocked and hurt the others. They would have thought and said, "Our relatives are precious to us, sick or well. However loathsome might be their malady, should we separate ourselves from them as if they were animals, just to save ourselves? It is unthinkable. It is unworthy of kinship. There is something wrong with whoever proposes such a thing." They would have seen it as a gross repudiation of fellow human beings. Mercifully, the cases were staggered. The severest ones improved before others worsened. At least it was so with the adults. Thus, there was always at least one woman able to prepare food and watch by the very sick ones, to do for them the simple things they could do, handing them a drink of water or rearranging the pillows and blankets for them. Beyond that, the sick asked nothing but to lie suffering quietly, much as animals might, and let the sickness have its way with them. Water Lily ministered to them, numb of spirit and body, too tired to think. She could only feel that here was something hideous to be lived through somehow. And then one night, little Robin died in her arms. Scarcely had she laid her body down and picked up her twin brother to hold him, then he too was gone. These were Water Lily's first major tragedies. Although she had grown up on intimate terms with death, as who did not? In the past, whenever she had wept over the dead, unless it was someone in her own family group, it was out of sympathy for the bereaved, or because the whole thing was dismal enough to arouse tears, or simply because it was proper to wail and one could generally work oneself up to it. It was proper to wail lest one be accused of being callous and negligent in their kinship. But now she wept because she must and could not check herself. When she was a very young girl, she had once pulled up her blanket over her head and wailed, utterly dry-eyed, and was at once ashamed of and amused at herself. She could not feel any such grief then as now. Not long after, her turn came and she lived through the wretched time of somehow, indifferent even to the horrid marks that appeared on her smooth young face to mar its beauty. The two men also were sick, one at a time, and that was a blessing. Not till Echo's husband was up did Sacred Horse take to bed. Always he lay with his face toward the teepee wall, thus shutting himself away from the others, asking only that Water Lily sit near his head to screen him from them. At his worst, he crawled out of the teepee without a word and remained under a tree some distance away. When he did not return, his mother grew anxious. "Daughter-in-law," she said, "my son does not return. Perhaps if you went out to him." Before she had finished the sentence, Water Lily went. "Your mother sent me. What is the trouble? Can't you get back? Is it that bad?" She did not chide him for coming out. There was nothing else for a sick adult to do so long as he had the strength and was in his right mind. In the interest of sanitation and modesty, adults always went outside to relieve themselves, no matter how they felt or what the weather. "I could get back well enough," Sacred Horse said, "but I intend to stay out here." He was lying on the grass. She sat quietly by him a long time until he spoke. "I may as well tell you that I am not going to recover. Even before this pestilence was a manifest thing, I knew that I would die before long. Of what precisely, I did not know then. You and the others have suffered too much already. I will not cause you further suffering by dying in the teepee where you must sit day and night. Can't you make some sort of little shelter for me here?" So Water Lily and Taluta set forked posts into the ground and laid poles crosswise on them. They threw their largest bullhide over the poles and weighted the bottom on three sides, leaving the fourth side partly exposed for air and light. When they had brought sage leaves for a couch and spreading a blanket over it, with supreme effort, he dragged himself over to it and lay down. "Now, go back and rest, both of you," he said. His mother went because she knew she was needed in the teepee. But Water Lily stayed by and gave him water whenever he asked for it. She brought out some broth his mother had made, but he did not touch it. It was late at night when he said to her, "You must go now and get some sleep." She was crying softly in the dark. When she could control her voice, she answered, But you might die. You might die in the night all alone." He was gallant all the way. "Could you prevent that by staying here?" And it was in him to chuckle a little, as sick as he was. Again, after she made no move to obey him, he said, "Look, I mean it. Leave me to meet this thing alone. I am very curious. Others die by themselves, and so can I." And then, with a touch of flippancy, he added, "This is a real male you have married, don't you know?" After that, Water Lily could not protest. Since it was his wish, she must obey. To insist would be to insult her husband, as though he were a child or a weakling whose mind could be changed for him. Dakotas always resented that. Quietly she withdrew in tribute to him. "He ordered me back," she told her mother-in-law, who accepted her son's wishes. "Very well. He always knew what he wanted. Very well, since it must be so." Water Lily did not sleep. She spent the night listening, worrying over him from a distance. As soon as it grew light enough, she went to him. Already he was stiff and cold. Weeping low, she drew his blanket up over his face very gently. It was a problem to lay the body away from anything like the tenderness and decency the matter required. Sacred Horse had been a tall, well-knit man, whereas his brother-in-law was slight and short, and not yet strong enough after his illness to handle the body alone. The women had to help him bind it to an improvised stretcher and hoist it into a tree that overhung the shelter where death had occurred. By means of rope pulleys, they raised the body and laid it across two branches. Then Echo's husband managed to climb up and make the ends of the bier secure to the tree. Ordinarily, men handled a man's body and women handled a woman's. But here, under grim necessity, the mother and wife and sister of Sacred Horse all had to help. They worked dry-eyed and stoical until it was done. It smote their hearts, by nature so tender with their dead, to see, on looking up, that the body did not lie level, that the head was considerably lower than the feet. But at least it was there to stay, well beyond the reach of animals. In that they found some comfort. After 2 days of mourning, Echo's mother proposed that they move to another spot along the stream, away from the scene of so much grief, where her son and two of her grandchildren had died. If they had remained there, they might have avoided further disaster. But they struck camp and traveled one entire day. There were now but six in their party, Water Lily and Echo, Echo's husband, her mother, and her two children, and the boy Little Bear and the babe in arms. On ground level, well protected on the north and west by hills rising away from the valley, they made their camp, with Buzzard Creek flowing below the steep bank not far from their teepee entrance. The woods were thick here and rich in autumn colors. The view was exceedingly beautiful and lonely, but there were evidences of game in the wooded ravines running down between the hills. Taluta roamed the woods and returned with more fuel than they could ever use. "Oh, but I marvel at the abundance of dead wood hereabouts. I cannot stop gathering it. Would that this wood were within reach of our camp circle," she exclaimed from time to time. Everyone was well now and waiting to be sent for. They were impatient and even debated the wisdom of starting homeward anyway. Echo said, "Mother, the nights are getting very chilly. It might snow on us out here. And then if we missed our location, how could we find our way back? Even now, all the land looks the same to me. With snow on the prairies, we would be lost." "No," her mother was emphatic. "Your father said he would send for us when it was safe, and he will. He knows where we are. From boyhood, he has roamed all over this region. We will wait." Echo could not budge her, and she did not try. And of course, Water Lily and Echo's husband would accept the decision out of respect for their mother-in-law, even if they disagreed with her. But one day, it was she, the mother, who came home worried. In the wood, she had seen a fresh track. It was much longer than that like of a Dakota moccasin. The three women put out the fire and sat in the teepee, growing more and more apprehensive as twilight came on. They spoke very low, and when they must. The worst of it was that Little Bear was still out somewhere, and his father had not yet come in from hunting. The boy never went beyond call, but to shout out to him was out of the question. They could only rely on his training to move stealthily whenever he was out alone, as he had been taught by his uncles to do so. After a long, tense wait, they relaxed a little, since nothing had happened. And Water Lily said, still whispering, "I will go to the bank and call softly. Perhaps my nephew is down by the stream." "Please do, sister-in-law," Echo said gratefully. "He may be fishing again, though I can't see why he bothers when none of us care for fish being plains people. How I dislike the smell of it. So nauseating." Water Lily moved cautiously, going straight out of the teepee toward the bank. She crouched low and peered into the dark shadows below for a sight of the boy before she would call. And it was lucky for her that she waited, for suddenly there were loud war whoops from beyond the teepee. Another raid! The cries and the din were designed to confuse the inmates of the teepee. The enemy were attacking from behind, apparently having crept up under cover of the buffalo berry bushes that studded the land clear back to the hills. Water Lily, in line with the teepee, had not been seen. In that sudden uproar, she started to run along the edge of the bank, but missed her footing and sprained an ankle. Next instant, she was rolling into a narrow gully that cut into the bank from the stream. Too frightened to act, she lay motionless. The screaming and yelling and the shooting of white men's guns, all the tribes were using them more and more, and the clatter of teepee poles being struck and broken continued. Her heart beat so loudly that the attackers must hear it, she thought, except for their frenzied racket and their shouting at one another in an unknown tongue, urging and exciting each other to move more and more havoc, no doubt. But at last the tumult died away as the enemy withdrew in the direction from which they came. Now Water Lily might safely come forth from her hiding place, were she not too stunned to make the effort. The gully fitted her body snugly. Looking up as though from an open grave, she could see the stars. The whole constellation of Man Being Carried, the Big Dipper, was in sight. At first it was over on one side of her fragment of sky. Not until it had swung around and was disappearing on the other side, however long that would take, could she work up enough courage to utter a sound. Even then, she could call only in a low voice, "Is anyone left alive?" There was no reply, After a while, she tried again. This time, Echo's voice moaned, "Sister-in-law, I am alone, alive, alas, but I am like one dead." Water Lily managed to climb up the bank. Able to walk, though her ankle was swelling badly, she limped back to the teepee. In the darkness, she felt Echo's head and wept to find that the scalp had been cut away, leaving a raw, wet spot on her crown. Elsewhere on her head were ugly gashes, too. Her baby, clasped to her arm still, was dead from an arrow that just missed Echo. Echo's mind came and went, and there was nothing to do but wait for daylight. Whenever she grew faint and cold, Water Lily rubbed her wrists and dashed cold water in her face. It was all she knew to do. Sometime after the attack, Little Bear had stolen into the teepee all a tremble. Young as he was, he had had the sense to lie low and thereby had saved himself. His father and grandmother were missing. It added to Water Lily's distress that he kept threatening to go out and look for them, and she had to keep begging him to stay in. When it grew light enough to see, they found Taluta lying dead some distance out, having been scalped and knifed savagely. In one of her lucid moments, Echo asked Water Lily to help her down to the stream. "I try to remember, but I keep forgetting," she explained, meaning she kept losing consciousness. "If I could just wet my face and head in living water, I might remember permanently." Water Lily was small-boned and of delicate build. The weight of the heavier woman leaning full against her put such a strain on her ankle that she could hardly bear it. But she managed to get Echo down to the water and seat her at the shallow edge. Echo apparently had the right idea. Living, flowing water was good medicine. Moving along with a will of its own, so it was said, a stream carried life-giving properties to everything that it touched along the way. As it could revive all manner of grasses and trees, so it also could revive mankind. Water was holy. From then on, Echo was able to retain her consciousness. On her way back, she paused by the body of her mother, still lying where it had fallen, and talked to the dead woman in the customary way, chiding her affectionately. "Oh, mother, mother, alas, it is thus that you must lie with me helpless. Once too often I have obeyed you, my mother, from force of habit, grown woman though I am, as though I were still a child. Oh, mother, if only we had started homeward when I wanted to go. But no. Wait for your father, you said. He will not fail us, you said." And she sat down for a long, unhindered cry beside her dead. Meantime, Water Lily prepared to lay her mother-in-law's body away. There was nothing to do but drag it to a heavy buffalo skin and to place it sufficiently removed from the camp and out of sight. There, she and the boy, Little Bear, carried stones to cover it. This they continued to do whenever they were at liberty, until the mound was so large that no marauder, lacking hands and the intelligence to remove stone after stone, could molest the body. Water Lily was thankful that she had thought in time to lay Echo's baby in its grandmother's arms, and so to finish the burial of both at once. The days that followed were a time of utter dejection. The wretched teepee, though Water Lily had mended it to the best of her ability, was no longer stormproof and no longer in shape to stand firm between short poles. When it rained, their things were soaked, and when winter came, it was plain they would suffer cruelly from the cold. The problem of food became desperate. until all they could rely on was an occasional rabbit that the boy snared, or a bird that he killed with his blunt arrows. Yet Echo made no further reference to going home, and Water Lily did not discuss the possibility of their trying it. She knew what Echo was waiting for, her husband's return. It was a futile hope. If he were alive, he would have been home long ago. But yet she clung to it in silence for many days. At last she could talk casually about their situation. "We must stay here until he gets back. Well, we have to stay here anyway, seeing that the enemy took all our horses. We are afoot. How could we go?" She was at last facing facts, but again there were times when her fortitude failed her. Then she would weep, always for her children. "Oh, if only they had been sick long enough to cause me weariness in watching over them. If only I might have suffered for want of sleep and felt fatigue in caring for them. How satisfying that would have been. If, in their illness, they had been whimsical and petulant with me, how gladly I should have stood it. But no, they had to die quietly and quickly without being any trouble. And that littlest one, she even died for me in my stead. Oh, if only I had been able to make pretty moccasins for their dear feet, that they might lie buried with them. These shall be my regrets till I die." At such times, she would not be comforted, and Water Lily was too wise to try. And then, when things were their blackest, when not a morsel of food remained, a rider stood on the hill above their camp looking down at them. "Quick, come inside. He may be an enemy scout." The three survivors huddled in the teepee, fearing the worst, until the man began to sing a dirge in Dakota. They knew then that whoever he might be, he realized their plight and would rescue them. He turned out to be a cousin of Echo, from a camp circle along the Missouri. Unaware of the petulance, he had come to visit his Uncle Good Hunter, who, in the same breath with which he had greeted him, had sent him out after his aunt and her party. "Oh, my nephew, it is well that you have come. Go at once and find your aunt and cousins and their families and bring them home. Tell them it is safe for them at last." And he had given him specific directions. The cousin, immediately upon his arrival, went out to hunt and returned shortly with the deer. It was the first real food they had had in many days, and so he saved their lives. But Echo still showed no disposition to hurry home, and he, understanding why, said nothing, only caring for their needs and protecting them from day to day. But one morning he came straight to Echo and stood near her as she sat on the ground. "My cousin," he said, "I have waited here with you, hoping your husband would one day return. I was prepared to wait all winter if need be. But now, alas, my cousin, I have to tell you that he will never return. Last evening I found his body out in the hills yonder where he met the enemy like a man." Echo heard this without tears. She seemed resigned. It might be that she had expected it all along. After a decent while, she said to Little Bear, "Son, find your aunt and tell her we will go home now." The cousin improvised a travois, and Echo rode on the seat behind. Water Lily rode the horse, which he led along. The boy walked by him or rode behind his aunt by turns. Before they left, they burned everything, including the teepee, each person saving only one fur robe for a wrap by day and for a cover for sleeping. They kept the barest of cooking necessities for the trip homeward. It was not wise to spend whole night sleeping on the way. They rested for short periods for a nap or some food and pushed steadily on, as much as one overburdened horse could stand. Okay, we are going to end here with our reading for this week. And it's a very sad reading. It's very hard to hear these things because we know that they actually happened. Even though this is a story, it's a novel, it's fiction. It's not a nonfiction book. But we know from our own history that these things happened. So it's sad to hear. But it is part of this story. And, of course, we are reading Water Lily by Ella Deloria. And I want to say Pidamia for being with me. And I am your host, Donna Hawkes, for Ohomani Iyotaka. And as always, I wishing you days ahead filled with good health and happiness. Doksha ake. We will meet again next week. This program is made possible with funding from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting.